Hey, everybody. Welcome back to episode 17 of Cold Case Murder Mysteries. This is the third installment covering the West Memphis Three child murders that occurred in Robin Hood Hills back in May of 1993. And today we're going to be discussing what is perhaps the most controversial aspect of the case, one that draws forth heated arguments as though it was a political discussion involving Donald Trump. That, of course, is the infamous confession Jesse Miskelly provided West Memphis detectives during an interrogation on June 3, 1993. But before we jump into that, I just want to reel off a few quick notes here. Be sure to follow me on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram, and remember that I always love hearing from listeners about their thoughts on the show. Inside of each post on my website is a contact form you can use to reach me whenever you like, but social media is probably an even better option. I get the pleasure of hearing from people all over the world, from here in the US to Australia, Sweden, the UK, and many more. It's truly a huge honor to have all of you as listeners. So with that said, please remember to subscribe and to rate and review the show with 5 stars on Apple Podcasts. And beyond that, there's one more thing I want to discuss before we descend into the darkness of this story. I get a lot of feedback from listeners that suggests they find the show entertaining and fascinating, but often they don't agree with my opinions. So I'd just like to offer a little bit of insight into who I am and how my opinions are formulated. And we'll do so in the context of these opinions getting created in the same manner as a podcast. So imagine you're sitting in front of your computer with an open audio file for editing. In this file, you have 2 tracks displayed as waveforms running horizontally across the screen. Now, if you hit play on this file, it's going to play both tracks simultaneously at the same volume and instantly negate the coherence of both. It simply becomes gibberish in a way that you can recognize many of the elements within, but wouldn't be able to extract enough of it to understand what was being said. However, had you been born listening to everything around you in this manner, you would be able to extract a greater degree of truth from the audio than those who weren't because, in the same way as someone blind having elevated senses otherwise, you'd have to rely on what was available to you. Okay, so to put this in the context of who I am as compared to most people, imagine the top waveform being labeled as the macro of our existence. And then, conversely, picture the lower waveform as the micro aspect of our existence. Now, the way the simultaneous noise of both of these tracks is supposed to occur to you, in your mind, parallels the way it would most make sense composed in a podcast. If you want to hear narration along with music, then the volume of the speaker's voice needs to greatly exceed the volume of the music. So in most intelligent people who function well, what you have is a human whose brain is wired to predominantly operate within the framework of everyday life, while the profound existential questions emanating from their souls remain nothing more than a flickering candle they recognize in times of reflection. Because the truth is this: we're just the puppets performing on stage. We were not intended to pull back the curtain on evolution and examine the process. Those who do so, to a great extent, are generally afflicted by something that causes a deficiency in cognitive function. Now, it's certainly a subject with answers that reside above and beyond my level of education, so the best way I can describe this deficiency in my brain is to say that the waveforms of the macro and the micro are merged. This means that everything I look at incurs profound evolutionary value, in addition to the inherent practicality of everyday life, so that I'm witnessing the thrust of evolution within the nuances and monotony of that everyday life. The symbolism and parallels are then drawn everywhere, and life just looks like a perfectly mapped grid where the interconnectedness of everything in this universe is abundantly apparent. Although this is undiagnosed, the fallout from it is that I'm extremely sensitive to food colors and textures and have absolutely no sense of direction. I actually struggle to find objects if someone else is pointing directly at them, and I was never able to learn how to read a map or understand GPS without audio. I also have no ability to comprehend mathematics and couldn't so much as pass algebra in high school without cheating. Occasionally, I still count on my fingers. On the positive side, I learned how to read fluently at age 3, and in less than a half hour, by imagining the text in a Star Wars book as an anagram that I solved by way of accounting for the frequency of vowel sounds as compared to the speech of my mother and grandmother having a conversation nearby in the kitchen. So, the bottom line is that the opinions I forge in my analysis, while incredibly bold and seemingly off base, are still entirely authentic to my existence. Because when you look at me and smile, I might see your happiness, but I also see the suicide attempt you contemplated 3 years ago, the effects of your father's alcoholism, and your fear of death. And it's hard for me to look away. Now, to cap off this notion, the best way to explain this, as it pertains to what I see, is to say that the merging of these waveforms in my brain perfectly parallels the way our two eyes, right and left, merge their field of view in the same manner to provide what? Depth perception. The deficiency in my brain allows me a greater deal of depth perception, as it pertains to thought produced by visuals, than most people would be afforded, because I'm seeing a greater degree of detail contained within each image, even if muddled. So then, also notice, if that's the case, how seeing too much detail in this matter would be detrimental to your life. Look at the nature of where my mind fails. Mathematics. 2 plus 2 equals 4. That is rigid, inflexible, and not open to interpretation. Therefore, applying logic in excess of, or different from, what's necessary will lead to failure. Again, look at the nature of following directions or reading a map. It's rigid and straightforward. Any effort to alter the perception of what you see or overthink the process will lead you to the wrong place. So ultimately, the merging of these waveforms allows me to excel anywhere examination is relevant, but fail miserably in an effort to see anything which must be seen clearly and defined, such as numbers, directions, and so on. Anyhow, that's just a bit of insight into who I am and what I do, for better or worse. I'm a terribly imperfect human, and you can always be sure I never expect to be right, even if I'm adamant in my stance. Now let's do this. It's June 3rd, 1993, and a 17-year-old male named Jesse Miskelly Jr. arrives at the police station in West Memphis to discuss any information he might have regarding the triple murder of three local 8-year-old Cub Scouts, Christopher Byers, Stevie Branch, and Michael Moore. Of course, the controversy here starts almost immediately because Jesse is still a minor, and is going to be interrogated in the absence of a parent or legal counsel. What we know for sure is that his father gave the police permission to conduct the interview, but there seem to be conflicting reports about whether or not the parental figure was actually at the police station during this time, or even a part of this time. Let's just say that we can verify that he wasn't in the room, and that will suffice for the purposes of our discussion because that isn't going to factor into my analysis of the situation, even though it is definitely significant from a legal standpoint. So, again, this explodes into controversy right off the bat because Jesse ends up being at the police station for 12 hours, a time frame for which many have mistakenly construed being the period of time he was interrogated before he broke and confessed due to exhaustion, pressure from the police, fear, etc. But even if those factors played a role in his confession, it has to be said that he actually confessed after approximately 4 hours. The remainder of that time, the police were asking him to reconstruct the story in an effort to uncover the allegedly guilty parties in a manner that would allow them to do the least amount of work, which is to secure enough information to obtain arrest warrants on all of these individuals for murder charges related to the boys that were killed in Robin Hood Hills. And that's a very important factor. One we need to understand takes precedence over the truth. Here's why. The cops are lied to continuously. 80% of being a cop is sorting through people's bullshit lies. All day long. Every day. Lies, lies, lies. In fact, that's what all of us do. But what makes it so hard for them is they have to engage this process knowing the clearly defined absolute truth won't be available 99.9% of the time because the consequences of telling them the truth might cost you your life behind bars. So, what they learn in this undertaking is that definitive truth is a rare bird that is hardly ever seen and virtually never caught and held captive. The end result is then that cops employ tactics to extract as much truth as possible from the people who are least willing to provide it. I mean, you don't ever hear horror stories about people who confessed a murder in the absence of controversy because of a single factor. They aren't telling lies. They're cooperating. Conversely, detectives relentlessly deceive the subject of their interrogation to give themselves leverage in a situation where, quite frankly, the person being asked to answer questions doesn't have to say shit. So what the cops do is search for doorways to the truth. And in this case, they did it in the same way I did. They identified the predator by way of its environment, and then proceeded accordingly by attacking its greatest weakness. This is not just the tactic we utilize during war, it's what we do during all confrontations, whether it's attacking emotions with words or attacking someone's body with physicality. For instance, if you're aiming to kill, you're probably not pointing the gun at somebody's foot. Or if you're attacking Scientology for leaving people broke and miserable, you're probably not using Tom Cruise as an example. Searching for the weak spot is the focal point in the art of conquest. Whether it's a man trying to seduce a woman by saying the right things, or a parent trying to quiet a young baby with milk, or even a dog getting tossed a treat so the damn thing will stop barking. This is what we do. And as discussed previously, I very clearly see the predator in this event as a rattlesnake. So, according to what I just outlined, the cops need to find its weakness, which will then make them the predator. That's when they can stop observing the prey and start moving in for the kill. Or in this case, the capture. And that didn't occur in this situation because the cops were brilliant. It occurred due to the inherent psychology of play by default of the undertaking. You see, this case was all about Damian Echols. He was clearly the star of the show and the leader of these three boys, whom everybody thought was the mastermind behind the crime. So you'd think they'd want to get their hands on him. And they do. But this is where evolution comes into play. Now, what we know about the anatomy of a rattlesnake is that the head is the rock star, the fangs and the poison, and everything else works in support of it. The body, during potentially violent confrontations, coils up and stiffens to elevate the head, a symbolic reference that flaunts the head's dominance and its propensity to strike. Yet what it also does is allow the snake to become taller, specifically giving it leverage over smaller predators, its main source of food. And during feeding, the body's purpose is to enable the movements of the head's desires as it searches for prey, and then to help the head discard of what it kills by concealing the bodies in a place where they're intended to rot. Accordingly, when the rattlesnake slithers out of the area, the dead are nowhere to be found. That's exactly what happened in this crime. But here's something interesting, and what brings us to the relevance to Jesse Miskelly. Certain rattlesnakes have been undergoing evolutionary changes in recent decades in America. And do you remember when I described Robin Hood Hills in a previous episode as a forest that butts up against the more urban residential areas that surround it? Well, this is exactly where the physical changes have been recorded, where rattlesnakes more often find themselves in contact with people. So here's what's happening, and also thoughts about why. These rattlesnakes, due to their proximity to so many humans, are coming in contact with people who know they're dangerous on a more frequent basis than they would in more secluded areas. Because of that fear, there is more likely going to be a backlash against them, and their numbers tend to suffer because people want to destroy them and eliminate the problem, whether they've attacked people or not. And isn't it strange that seems to be the narrative in West Memphis regarding Damian Echols, Jason Baldwin, and Jesse Miskelly? That they were doomed from the start by nature of what they were. They dressed in black, listened to heavy metal, and engaged the occult, including Satanism and black magic, cumulatively giving an impression of potentially causing death, a misunderstanding that subsequently leads to their destruction. But the reason that this occurs is this, and it's very sound logic. When you see a live rattlesnake, by default of its nature, you already know that it struck before and caused death. Accordingly, what change have these rattlesnakes undergone? Their tails no longer rattle. And why? In order to avoid detection by humans, because evolution knows the tipping point has come where having the rattle, in this specific environment, is a burden rather than an advantage, because their main predator, humans, simply don't respond to the rattle in the way a smaller predator would in the wild. And the reason is the same logic the cops used for picking up Jesse Miskelly first. He's the rattlesnake's tail. So again, let's examine that for a moment. What do I mean? Okay, what's happening when the rattlesnake is shaking its tail is that it's making a threat against perceived danger. But a cursory analysis of that reveals one has to experience fear in order to have such a reaction. So, any threat that does not constitute an action is really just a reflection of your fear to not act on your desire. Basically, what the tail is saying is that it doesn't want to attack, but it will. So what is that specifically telling the other party to do? To flee. To get out of there before they get killed. Accordingly, that becomes the next parallel, in the sense that we're about to see an elaborate confession from Jesse that details exactly what I've described. That he didn't want to do this, and even tried to help the prey flee, but in the end he was willing to comply with the desires of the head and the subsequent compliance and movement of the body that compelled him to follow. That isn't just similar to what happens in his confession. We're going to see that it parallels his confession in every way. And the reason he talks is because the tail talks. And what that rattler says specifically about itself, what it screams up in bright neon lights, is one word that allows the police to pounce. Insecurity. The rattle of the snake's tail is nothing more than a reflection of its insecurities. It's the weak link, and is unable to disguise the physical manifestation of fear. Again, that's Jesse Miskelly. He's the weak link, not because of his intellect, even if that contributes greatly to the effect. No, the reason they go after Miskelly is because they already know, intuitively through default of evolutionary considerations, that he's the one who's going to emote fear. And just like the rattlesnake's tail shaking, when they hear him speak, it will be apparent in his voice. And what do those fears actually reflect? The insecurity of the head. And guess what? That's why the head needed the tail in the first place. It doesn't need a best friend with whom to prey. It just needs something to deflect the perception of its weakness and fear to an image other than its head. And that's the reason the best way to approach a snake is from behind at its tail. You can ultimately bypass the body and grab the back of its head without it seeing you approach, thereby capturing it and preventing it from striking again. But what you learn instantly is this. The creature had reason to be afraid of you, for this specific reason. In the absence of lashing out and causing harm or death, it has no defense system. It has no ability to reason. It's simply a killing machine, by default of its design. This was the West Memphis 3. Now, let's take a quick look at the physical implications of the rattlesnake as compared to these teens as they were in 1993. Damien Eccles was the largest and most dangerous of the three, most prone to lashing out in violent incidents specifically intended to draw blood, even reported incidents of sucking blood from the wounds of others. He even described himself as homicidal while institutionalized. Next is Jason Baldwin, who was smaller, younger, and therefore subordinate to Eccles, his only close friend, to whom he was nearly attached all the time as they moved about town, in the same way as the anatomy of the rattlesnake head and body working in conjunction to slither through the forest. And notice how the tail, the rattler, is irrelevant in all of that. Notice how Jesse is always mentioned as not being a friend of Damien's, just somebody he saw on occasion. The reason is this. The rattler is only necessary in situations where the snake is preying or being preyed upon. Accordingly, we have Jesse only participating in this story during the prey, killing the boys, and then again when the snake needs to defend itself from a larger predator, the cops. Jesse's supposed alibi, which could never be confirmed, and which involves him being at a wrestling tournament or similar during the time of the killings, has him nowhere near Jason and Damien. But Jason and Damien's lackluster explanations for their whereabouts that evening do intertwine. So Jesse plays a very specific role within the trio, and the cops recognize that, as the rattler, and as it pertains to this crime, Jesse is nothing more than the reflection of Damien's insecurities. So, the cops were able to sever the tail from the snake by getting to Jesse first, and in doing so, they were able to gain insight into what made the predator tick, specifically the fears, anxieties, and rage that led to the vicious strike that killed these boys. This is very simply just nature at play here. That's all it is. Now look how Jesse Miskelly confessing to the police parallels the notion of severing the tail, the one that serves no purpose but to rattle due to insecurity and fear that represents the thoughts of violence residing within the head of the snake. So then, in the same way evolution recognizes that the rattlesnake's rattle was starting to get it killed in large numbers in forest areas butted up against developed residential zones, Damien, Jason, and Jesse then also came to realize that the reason they were ultimately doomed to their downfall was the same thing. The tail was meant to rattle. It was meant to talk. It was designed to emanate fear. And in the end, it did exactly what nature intended. And nature, in order to fix the problem that arose in the aftermath, responded in a manner that mirrored what the cops did. It silenced the snake by removing the rattle. That's evolution. That's the buzzing in your head, the words on the tip of your tongue, that interconnectedness of everything you see in the eyes of somebody you love, and the thoughts that keep you up at night staring at the stars. All of that is real, and what it's telling you is that the answer to anything lies in everything. It's the reason the ideal of unity is so precious. Think about this for a moment. The frequency and depth of your love for other people begins in your immediate family and extends outward to the rest of the world as it thins in importance, which reveals us as an incredibly tribal being, constantly seeking to group ourselves into more and more exclusive categorizations that become smaller and smaller until there is only a number one at the top of the list. This is not coincidental. This pyramid is the evolutionary ascension of humanity, and the exact fucking reason the shape of a pyramid was conceived to begin with, even if only subconsciously. But what we learn from it is that when you stack these stones, what it symbolizes is that, despite the myriad number of rows of stones in the pyramid, representing the nearly infinite number of groups of people in the world, everything ultimately narrows to one stone at the top, representing the fact that we are a single being in the pursuit of a single plight that is then symbolized as progress by reaching for the sky and stars above. I know. Some of you still doubt me. And this is where I go back to the movie It. There's a scene where the boy who's a hypochondriac is walking through a yard, and he suddenly turns to see Pennywise with his face obscured by an inverted pyramid constructed of red balloons that narrow down to one balloon covering his face. Of course, the balloons symbolize the children floating, and their color of red symbolizes blood, but the inverted pyramid is indicative of the desire to reverse evolution by killing. It's the inversion of our evolutionary plight, which ends in showing us that the face hiding behind the final balloon at the bottom of the pyramid, which is the face of evil or Satan that resides beneath this plight, in the same way as hell, is represented by Pennywise. And again, what is Pennywise? The manifestation of fear of change, as it pertains to transcending childhood into adulthood. And of course, as I discussed previously, I strongly believe that's why this crime took place. Because these three were floating, aimless, and angry about it. And that's the foundation upon which they built this predatory creature known as the rattlesnake. It was the bond that cemented their association. But back to Jesse, once he, as the tail, is severed from the rest of the rattlesnake by the cops getting to him, he no longer has that conduit of fear from which to siphon insecurity. He no longer has any attachment to the desires of the head that are transferred through the body. And the cops know he's out on an island in that regard. He feels the need for purpose and recognizes himself as native to that function. So what did the detectives do? They reconstruct the rattlesnake behind closed doors, with the two of them as the head and body, and Jesse is the tail succumbing to their every desire by way of the only thing that gets him to respond. Fear. If they intimidate him, he's going to rattle. So, here we are at June 3rd, 1993, in the room with Jesse Miskelly and Detectives Ridge and Mitchell at 2:44 p.m., at the time Jesse's statement begins recording. Now, before we discuss this transcript, let me just be upfront about the fact that I do believe it's a coerced confession toward which Jesse was led, one that reveals many factual errors and can easily leave anyone reading it believing that it is a false confession drawn from a scared kid who was intellectually unfit to handle the situation. Of course, it also goes without saying that a minor shouldn't be confessing to murder in the absence of his parents or legal representation, regardless of his guilt or innocence. It's just not a process that somebody with so little life experience is equipped to handle, especially somebody like Jesse Ms. Kelly, who has a ninth grade education and a low IQ. So, on that note, his IQ is debatable, with some placing it just beneath the bar of what would be considered mentally handicapped, while others believe his intellectual capacity actually resides a bit above that determination. This is the result of a couple of IQ tests with varying results. However, I think the one thing we can say for sure is that his confession should not have happened under the circumstances in which we're about to witness. So, in that regard, whether the three are innocent or guilty, this has always been a case that deserved another look. With that said, I do believe Jesse participated in this crime, and despite the cops' atrocious handling of the process, in the end they got exactly what they wanted in the way they wanted it, which is something they couldn't get from Jason or Damien at the time, and still haven't 25 years later. Their instincts were correct. They snuck up on the rattlesnake by way of its tail, and then snatched it by the back of the head and extracted the poison within to utilize as an antivenin to the death it caused with its strike that killed Christopher Byers, Stevie Branch, and Michael Moore. It's that simple. But then they needed to attach Jesse as the tail of this new rattlesnake. Yet he's afraid of the cops. He's on the other side of the law, the other side of the table, and alone while the other two men questioning him are acting as a team. The symbolism is just as miserable for him as the reality. So naturally, what are the detectives going to do? They're going to offer him an opportunity to become part of this unit and do something he doesn't want to do by preying on his fears and insecurities in the same way as Damien and Jason. And why? Because they already know, by default of his participation in the murders, that he's going to say yes. And how? Because he's just the same as every one of us. He doesn't want to be alone. And that is the key to unlocking the truth in this confession. Spatial relationships, specifically the retrospective of spatial relationships as they play out within the crime scene as Jesse recreates it in his mind. The second significant factor in how this plays out is power dynamics within the interrogation room. And the combination of the two of those things will be what gives us Jesse's misguided, sometimes outrageous, and inaccurate confession. So, the way the detectives get Jesse to join them in forming this new rattlesnake, at which point he'll shake again and the truth will come out, is to show him a physical depiction of how they, the cops, are part of a unit as a predator, while he is alone and surrounded as the prey, with no way out. They do this by showing Jesse a piece of paper with a circle drawn on it. Within the circle is an X or a dot. Either way, it's a singular mark that is not accompanied by anything else. It's alone, and surrounded by the unity and power of the circle. The symbolic importance of this would be inherent in Jesse's brain even without further explanation, something he could feel, if not articulate, but the cops go on to spell it out for him anyway. They tell him that they, the police, are the circle on the outside, and that Jesse is the lone X in the center. And then they ask him, "Now where do you want to be? Do you want to be inside the circle like you are now? Or do you want to be outside it with us?" And so then give some more thought to how Jesse might respond. In my mind, if he was so desperate to be part of any circle, or any unit or rattlesnake, that he reluctantly involved himself in murder just to be a part of the team, then he is definitely going to be even far more desperate now and looking to join any team he can. In fact, the cops are the only team, and they're very powerful. Just look at what they're offering him. They told him that if he cooperates, he can excuse himself from the scrutiny of their gaze at the center of the circle and join them outside it. They're offering him a chance to be on their side. So he takes it. Except, by default, we already know this is a lie, because at the end of the story, after admitting to the act of murder, he's going to find himself alone inside the circle again. In the interview room, in jail, in the courthouse for his trial, and then in prison. Joining the cops is a temporary promise that quickly fades into oblivion due to one factor. The power he's been promised by joining the group is a lie, in the same way it was when he decided to join Damien and Jason to commit murder. And this plays out in the confession in the most hilarious way. What we're going to experience is Jesse repeatedly trying to physically extract himself from the location of the crime in his retelling, every time he doesn't want to admit wrongdoing and desires to be outside the circle with the cops. He literally keeps saying that he left, and the cops keep ignoring this notion and just casually place him back at the crime scene again. To most observers, what the cops are doing is going to appear absolutely unacceptable, even insane. But the truth of the matter is that they have offered Jesse an illusion. So every time he tries to reach for the fruits hanging from that tree, the branches simply rise a bit higher out of his grasp. The promise is just the carrot in front of the horse's nose. And as he travels deeper into the story, his desperation becomes that much greater. Yet, what's also happening is, as his desperation increases to catch the carrot, he's going to be coerced into telling the truth by the perpetually unfulfilled promise that he can finally get outside that circle and win. But there is no win, because he is the prey, and he's outmatched. So in the wild, what do outmatched prey do in order to escape their circumstances? Evolution provides them leverage, which helps these creatures create situations that can potentially allow them to survive their circumstances. That's what keeps their numbers healthy. For instance, the porcupine is covered in spines, certain toads or frogs are camouflaged, and a moose has a rack that can damage even the largest bear. But none of these are guarantees, and they don't offer the potential to win. They simply offer the potential to survive the situation. And that's what Jesse does with the only leverage he has. So we have to ask ourselves this. If Jesse wants to be on the outside of the circle, but still knows intuitively that it isn't actually possible, despite the promises he's received from the cops, then he's going to react as though he's about to be preyed upon. In doing so, alone in this room, he has to examine the only leverage he has, which is a very simple conclusion. His leverage is that he knows everything that took place the day of the murders, and the cops don't. Now, due to the desperation and high stakes of this situation, he's forced to play both sides of the fence. He wants to believe the promise of the cops and follow their lead, but also retain his leverage because he senses this is ultimately going to be an attack on his livelihood. So, accordingly, in providing answers to detectives, Jesse is going to cater to not only the desires of the police by producing a story that satisfies them, but he's also going to retain many elements of truth in order to still protect himself. Because he's desperate and doesn't know what to do. He's confused, and the end result of his confession follows that narrative. Confusion. But let's diagram what this loss of leverage is like, so that we can understand his motivation. Take the table out of the interrogation room. Instead, it's a seesaw with Jesse on one side and a detective on the other. The second detective is standing next to them. Now, the seesaw is perfectly balanced as the interview begins because the cop is the one with power and authority, which makes him heavy. But Jesse, though powerless to escape, has spines like the porcupine that keep the cops from swallowing him whole. And those spines are his leverage, what's holding down his side of the seesaw to make it even with the cop. So let's represent Jesse's leverage with a stack of bricks sitting in front of him. Each one of those is a truthful answer that links him to the crime in some way, and every question the detective asks is a request for one of the bricks. At first, it's going to feel good to cooperate. There's going to be a sense of weightlessness beginning, the pressure of the weight of these truths being lifted from his conscience. But as he gives away more and more of them, he starts to notice something. The bricks are piling up on the cop's side, and his own feet are beginning to lift off the floor with each one as the weight shifts to the other side. So, intuitively, he's going to understand that he's losing leverage. And soon enough, if he keeps telling the truth, his feet are going to leave the floor, the cop will have all the bricks, and he'll be stuck in that place forever because there's no way to get the bricks back and regain the leverage. The secret to maintaining the bricks, however, is to not let the cop know they exist. So Jesse is going to pepper the truth with lies, and vice versa, because it's enough to keep the cop saying that he's on their side. And he does this to see if it will get them to follow a narrative that truly does allow him to escape the circle and join them. But just like Jesse, the cops have peppered their truth with a lie, and the end result is that you get both parties proceeding into what seems a ludicrous, forced confession that is actually a battle of leverage played out entirely through the subtext of their false agreement to allow Jesse to join this newly formed rattlesnake outside the circle. So, what we're going to see ultimately is that Jesse excuses himself visually from the crime scene as the cops are pondering the story with their mind's eye, and he does so repeatedly. But guess what he doesn't try to separate himself from? All the shit that's made up. He gladly admits he was a 3-month member of a cult that killed dogs and carried girls into the woods where they would have orgies with them. And these were the same people who showed him a picture of the 3 boys who were murdered a week before the crime. A photo that was kept in a briefcase. Jesse happily admits this. In fact, he even goes on to say that these boys were raped by Damien and Jason before being killed, even when the evidence after the crime doesn't suggest it ever happened. He actually makes the story sound much worse than what might actually have happened, in terms of suffering and humiliation, and never tries to distance himself from this in any way. And guess where he ends up getting a life sentence? When he says that one of the boys ran off, but chased him down and brought him back. And isn't it funny as Jesse gives that statement that is going to cost him a life sentence plus 40 years? He does so believing in the ignorance of the cop's promises that he's going to be allowed back outside the circle with them once he does. But look what happened to the boy who tried to escape the inner circle when he was surrounded by the rattlesnake. He got chased down by Jesse and brought back within the circle to endure his true fate. And that's exactly what happens to Jesse Miss Kelly for admitting it. There's the mirror. He's brought back into the circle, and they take away his life by arresting him for murder. Parallels. They're everywhere. That's karma. It's nothing more than a reflection of the symbolism inherent in the situation. And the reason this happens, the reason the war is waged beneath the surface of this interrogation, in the subtext, is because of the nature of sophistication, as it pertains to living creatures. All creatures are sophisticated in terms of motivation. It happens by default of their evolutionary plight to survive and thrive. Everything living is hardwired with the desire to survive, even if it's disabled. Every creature, therefore, does whatever is within its means to try to accomplish this goal. Now, the most sophisticated of creatures, such as humans, are able to utilize articulation of thought in combination with reason in order to perpetually ask one pertinent question. Why? So, for Jesse Miss Kelly, whose ability to articulate and reason is hampered by his low IQ, especially in the face of the fearsome cops, he's going to be left with only one choice, and that's to engage his most primal survival instincts by trying to sneak the truth past them in order to make his way to safety. This strategy would be best likened to when you catch your dog trying to sneak past you with a chicken breast in its mouth that it knows it isn't supposed to have. And while it seems ridiculous that the dog would try to fool you in that manner, because you're right there witnessing it, the truth is that the animal's motivation to survive greatly exceeds its desire to be truthful, and the result is comedy. In fact, we all know the picture of the dog sitting around the poker table is hilarious for one reason. Dogs can't bluff. But what they can do is remain relentless in their pursuit, simply because they excel at being motivated to compensate for their lack of sophistication. And that's what Jesse is going to exhibit to a certain extent here because he's desperate and outmatched. He's going to continue to go to the well for water because he just isn't sophisticated enough to reroute himself down to the river to find it. So, this is Detectives Ridge and Gitchell taking the recorded confession of Jesse Miss Kelly Jr. on June 3rd, 1993.
This is Detective Brian Ridge of the West Memphis Police Department.
Currently in the West Memphis Police Department.
Conducting an investigation for the offense of triple homicide. Case file number 9305-0666. Currently in the office with Jesse Lloyd Miskelly Jr., birth date 7/10/75, education as a ninth grade. The place we are in the detective division, today's date is 6/3/93. The time now is 2:44 p.m. Present in the interview will be Inspector Gary Gitchell and Jesse Miskelly. Jesse, in front of me I have a rights form. It's got your signature at the bottom of it. Is that your signature?
Yes, sir.
Okay. We're informing you that we are Detective Sergeant Mike Allen and Detective Brian Ridge. Now, Detective Sergeant Mike Allen is the one that read this form to you earlier. Is that correct?
Yes, sir.
And I was here when he read it to you.
Yes, sir.
All right. Police officers of the West Memphis Police Department. We're conducting an investigation for the offense of capital felony murder, which was committed on or about 5/5/93. Before we ask you any questions, you must know and understand your legal rights. Therefore, we warn and advise you that you have the right to remain silent. Do you understand that?
Yes.
And those are your initials on the line in front of that statement?
Yes, it is.
Okay. Anything you say can be used against you in court. Do you understand that?
Yes, I do.
And those are your initials?
Yes, it is.
You have the right to talk to a lawyer for advice before we ask you any questions and have him with you during questioning. You understand that?
Yes, I do.
And those are your initials?
Yes, it is.
If you cannot afford a lawyer, one will be appointed for you before any questioning if you wish, no cost to you. You understand that?
Yes, I do.
And those are your initials?
Yes, it is.
If you decide to answer questions now without a lawyer present, you will still have the right to stop answering at any time. You understand that?
Yes, I do.
And those are your initials?
Yes, it is.
You're up here of your own free will. You right. came up here to answer some questions, and basically we found out some information during those questions. Is that correct?
Yes, I do.
Okay. At the bottom of this form is a waiver of rights. It says, I have read this statement of my rights, and I understand what my rights are. I am willing to make a statement and answer questions. I do not want a lawyer at this time. I understand and know what I am doing. No promises or threats have been made to me, and no pressure or force has been used against me. Is all that correct?
Yes, it is.
Okay. And you signed the bottom of the form?
Yes, I do.
Okay. It's witnessed by Michael Wayne Allen and myself, Detective Brian Ridge. Okay, Jesse, let's go straight to that date, 5/5/93, a Wednesday early in the morning. You received a phone call, is that correct?
Yes, I did.
And who made that phone call?
Jason Baldwin.
All right, what occurred? What did he talk about?
He called me and asked me, could I go to West Memphis with him? And I told him, no, I had to work and stuff. And then he told me he had to go to West Memphis. So him and Damien went, and then I went with them.
All right, when?
Wednesday.
All right, when did you go with them?
That morning.
At 9 o'clock in the morning?
Yes, I did.
Okay.
I went with them. And then
Now, were you in a car? Whose car were you on?
We walked.
Y'all
walked? Okay. Right, we walked. And then
Where did you go?
Went up to Robin Hood.
You went to the Robin Hood. Explain to me where those woods are.
About Blue Beacon, Turquoise.
Just a little patch of woods.
Little patch of woods.
Behind Blue Beacon?
Behind it. Right back there behind it.
Okay. What occurred while you were there?
When I was there, I saw Damien hit this one boy real bad. And then he started screwing him and stuff. And then,
All right, you've got in front of you a picture that was taken out of the newspaper, I believe. It's got three boys. And these are the three boys that were killed on that date in Robin Hood Woods. Okay. Which one of those three boys is it you say Damien hit? The third picture, which will be
this boy right here?
Yeah.
All right, that's the buyer's boy.
Christopher.
That's who you're pointing out?
Mm-hmm.
If you'll read the caption, the grizzly slaying from left, 8-year-old Michael Moore, Stephen Branch, and Christopher Byers. Okay. So you saw Damien strike Chris Byers in the head. What did he hit him with?
He hit him with his fist and bruised him all up real bad. And then Jason turned around and hit Steve Branch.
Okay.
And started doing the same thing. Then the other one took off. Michael Moore took off running. So I chased him and grabbed him and held him till they got there, and then I left.
Okay. All right. When you get the boys back together, where are you at from the creek?
I was up by the service road.
Up by the service road? Okay. Now, when he hits the first boy, where are they at when he hits him? Are you in the woods? Are you on the side of the big bio? Are you out in the field? Where are you at?
I was in the woods.
In the woods. Okay, you've been down there in those woods before. Can you describe to me what in those woods, what's the location where you were? Is there a path you go down?
I was down a little path.
All right, where does that path go to?
It lead out there close to the field, close to the interstate.
Okay.
That's where I was at.
All right.
I was close by the interstate.
When he hits the first boy, and then Jason hits another boy, and one takes off running, where does he run to?
That one, he runs out, going out the park, and I chased him and grabbed him and brought him back.
Which way does he go? I mean, does he going back towards where the houses are? Is he going to Blue Beacon? Is he going out towards the field? Where's he running to?
Towards the houses.
Towards the houses.
Where the pike is that goes across the water?
Yeah.
Okay.
He run out there, and I caught him and brought him back. And then I took off.
Okay. Well, you came back a little bit later, and all three boys are tied.
Mm-hmm.
Is that right?
And then I took off and went home.
All right. Have they got their clothes on when you saw them tied?
They had them off.
They had already gotten them off. When he first hit the boy, when Damien first hit the first boy, did they have their clothes on then?
Mm-hmm.
All right. When did they take their clothes off?
Right after they beat up all three of them and beat them up real bad.
Beat them up real bad. And then they took their clothes off.
And then
they tied them?
Then they tied them up, tied their hands up. They start screwing them and stuff, cutting them and stuff. And I saw it and I turned around and looked. And then I took off running. I went home. And then they called me. Asked me how come I didn't stay. I told him I just couldn't.
He just couldn't stay for them.
I couldn't stand to see what they were doing to him.
Okay. Now, when it's going on, when it's taking place, you saw somebody with a knife. Who had a knife?
Jason.
Jason had a knife. What did he cut with the knife? What did you see him cut, or who did you see him cut?
I saw him cut one of the little boys.
All right, where did he cut him at?
He was cutting him in the face.
Cutting him in the face. All right. Another boy was cut, I understand. Where was he cut at?
At the bottom.
On his bottom? Was he face down and he was cutting on him, or?
He was.
Are you talking about bottom? Do you mean right here?
Mm-hmm.
In his groin mm-hmm. area? Okay.
So you know what his penis is?
Yeah. That's where he was cut at.
That's where he was cut.
Which and boy was that?
That right there.
You're talking about the Byers boy again? Okay.
Are you sure that he was the one that was cut?
That's the one I seen him cutting on.
Okay. Do you know what a penis is?
Yes.
All right. Is that where he was cutting?
That's where I seen him going down at. And he was on his back. I seen him going down like that real close to his penis and stuff. And I saw some blood and that's when I took off.
Were y'all close to the creek at that point?
Yes, sir.
Where was the little boy actually at?
He was close. About.
All right, do you know where the bio is?
Right.
All right, and you know where the little creek is that goes out to the expressway? And doesn't have a lot of water in it, but it's got some water in it, and it's flowing through there. Which side of that creek were you on? Were you on the Memphis side of the creek, or were you on the Blue Beacon side of that creek?
Blue Beacon.
On the Blue Beacon. Mm-hmm. So there's like a tall bank. Where were you at on that bank?
I was up at, standing up at on top.
All right, where were they at?
They was at the bottom.
On which side?
The Memphis side.
They were on the Memphis side.
I was on the...
All right, we're going to correct that even further. That's the east side. Memphis side is the east side. And you were standing at the top of the bank on the west side. Were you looking down at what was going on?
I was looking down. After I seen all that, I took off.
Okay. And when you left, did you hear any more hollering or anything?
No.
All right. You went home. And about what time was it that all this was taking place?
They called me about...
I'm not saying when they called you. I'm saying what time was it that you were actually there in the park?
I was there about 12.
About noon? Okay. Was it after school? Had let out?
I didn't go to school.
Well, these other boys... No.
They skipped school.
They skipped school.
They was going to catch their bus or stuff, and they was on their bikes. So,
all right. They were on their bikes. Where were their bikes at?
They laid their bikes down when they came out there to the... When they hollered for them, told them to come out there.
Where did they lay their bikes down? That's what I'm asking.
I don't know where they laid their bikes at down there. Because I was behind Damien and them, way, way behind them.
Okay.
And when they hollered, and I seen the boys...
Little boys came on over. Mm-hmm. Had Damien seen these boys before?
Yes.
Has he done things with them before? Or has he just been watching them? Has he ever had sex with any of them before?
No, he's been watching them.
He's been watching them. You mentioned earlier that at one of the meetings you went to with this cult thing, they had some pictures. Describe those pictures for me.
It has some houses, the trees and stuff.
Okay. Had somebody taken pictures of these boys? Mm-hmm. Were they in the houses or were they in these trees when they took those pictures?
They were at the houses.
At the houses. Did they take, like, one picture of one boy?
It was in a group.
Always three?
It was a group of pictures of three. All three of them.
All three of them would generally be together.
Mm-hmm.
How many pictures did you see all together?
I just saw one.
Okay. And it had these same three boys in it?
Mm-hmm.
You're certain of that?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Nate, did you say the boys skipped school that day? These little boys did?
Mm-hmm.
Are you sure?
They was going to catch their... Going somewhere. And like I said, Damien and them left before I did. I told them I'd meet them there. And stuff. I had to get ready and stuff. I meet them there. And it was early in the morning, so they went ahead and met me up. They went ahead and went up there, and then I came up, you know, later on behind them.
What time did you get there?
I got there about 9.
In the morning?
Mm-hmm.
Of Wednesday morning?
Mm-hmm.
And when?
What time is it right now?
Right now?
Yeah. You don't know what time it is?
Do you not wear a watch?
It's at home.
My dad
woke me up this morning.
Your time period might not be exactly right, what you're saying.
Right.
But it was like early in the day, but you don't know exactly what time. Okay. Because I've got some real confusion with the times you're telling me. But now, this 9 o'clock in the evening call that you've got, explain that to me.
Well, after all the stuff happened that night, that they done it.
Okay.
I went home about noon. Then they called me at 9 o'clock that night. They called me.
Okay. And what did they tell you on the telephone?
They asked me how come I left so early and stuff. Then I told them I couldn't stand there watching it no more, so I had to do something to get out of there.
Okay. Who called you?
Jason.
And you mentioned you heard some voice in the background? And what else? I think you said that he made the call from his house?
He made a call from his house. And Damien was hollering in the background and said, "We done it, we done it. What we going to do if somebody saw us? What we going to do?"
Okay. Now, the knives. Was there one knife, two knives? Was your knife there?
Mm-hmm.
Did somebody take you and use your knife? Do you have a knife?
I got one knife.
Where is it at?
It's at home.
Okay. The knife that you said Jason was using, where is it?
I don't know what he done with it, because after I left, then that's when I don't know what they done with it. After I left, I don't know what they done with it.
He didn't tell you he hid it somewhere?
I got a feeling here. You're not quite telling me everything. Now, we're recording everything. So this is very, very important to tell us the entire truth. If you were there the whole time, then tell us you were there the whole time. Don't leave anything out. This is very, very important. Now, just tell us the truth.
I was there until they tied him up. And then that's when I left. After they tied him up, I left.
But you saw him cutting on the boys.
I saw him cutting on them.
And then what else left is there
They laid the knife down beside him, and I saw him tying them up, and then that's when I left.
Were the boys conscious, or were they...
They was unconscious then.
Unconscious.
Okay. And then after I left, they done more.
They done more?
They started screaming again.
Okay. How were they screaming them when you saw them?
Jason stuck his in one of them's mouth, and Damien was screaming one of them up the ass and stuff.
Okay. Alright, and the one that they were cutting the penis off of, did any of them, or cutting the penis or whatever was being done, did they have sex with him at home?
No.
Did either one of them?
Jason did.
Jason did.
Jason was screwing him while Damien stuck his mouth and letting the boys mouth.
Okay. How did he have sex with that one?
Damien, he was holding him down, right?
Uh-huh.
And Jason had his legs up in the air and that little boy was kicking, saying, don't, like that.
Okay. He had his legs up in the air. All right. What was to keep these little boys from running off? If just their hands are tied, what's to keep them from running off?
Well, they beat them up so bad, well, they can't hardly move. They haven't had their hands tied down. Right, sit on them.
You said they had their hands tied up, tied down. Were their hands tied in a fashion to where they couldn't have run? You tell me.
They could run. They just had them tied. When they knocked them down, and stuff, they can hold their arms and stuff, and sit, hold them down like where he couldn't raise up, and the other one pick his legs up.
Okay. So they had him under control. You were there the whole time that was taking place?
I was there.
Okay. One of them was cut on the face real bad. Is that what you said?
Mm-hmm.
And one of them was being cut on his penis.
Yes, sir.
All right.
Did anyone use a stick and hit the boys with?
Damien had kind of a big old stick when he hit that first one. After he hit him with his fist, knocked him down, then he got him a big old stick and hit him.
What did the stick look like? I mean, was it like a big log like that, or is it a stick?
I'd say it was about that big round. I'd say about that round.
Okay.
About the size of a baseball bat, maybe just a little bit bigger around.
Yeah.
That's what you described with your hands, right?
Right.
Okay. How long was the knife that Jason was using?
About that.
All right. You're describing a knife that would be about 6 inches long, is that right?
Mm-hmm.
And what kind of blade did it have on it?
Like a regular, just a regular knife blade.
Was it a knife that you fold up, or was it like a hunting knife that's just one piece?
Just you fold up knife.
It was a folding knife?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Does Damien have a knife? He didn't have one? He didn't have one that night?
He didn't have one that night.
Did he borrow yours?
No, he didn't borrow mine.
Okay.
Did they have a briefcase with them? You didn't see a briefcase?
I didn't see a briefcase. Not unless they left it there that day before it happened. Not unless they left it there then, but I didn't see it then that day.
Have you ever seen them with a briefcase before?
I seen that one night. I seen it with them that night.
Okay. What is kept inside that briefcase?
They have some cocaine and a little gun.
Is that where you first saw the pictures
mm-hmm.
of the boys?
I didn't make sure.
And you saw the pictures in the briefcase?
Mm-hmm. I heard when we had that cult.
Okay. Now, you have participated in this cult, right?
Yes.
How long have you been involved in it?
Been in about 3 months.
Okay. Tell me some of the things y'all do typically in the woods as being in this cult.
We go out, kill dogs and stuff, and then kill girls out there.
All right, what do you do with the girls when you're out there?
We screw them and stuff.
Does just everybody take turns?
Everybody, and all have orgies and stuff like that.
Okay.
When you kill a dog, what do you do with it?
We usually skin it, build a bonfire, and eat it and stuff.
Okay, when you're initiating somebody new to come into a cult, what actually is done to initiate that person into the cult?
We usually, you know, kill the animals, you know, see if he knows, you know, how to handle the meat and stuff. After we kill him, see if he knows, if he can't handle it, then he don't get in.
Okay, so he kills an animal. You mentioned earlier that he may have to eat part of that animal. What part of the animal would he eat?
Part of this, meat off his leg.
Meat off his leg.
And if he can't eat it, then he don't get in.
Doesn't get into the club. Okay. Now, on these meetings, have they ever been violent? Anybody gotten mad and gotten a fight?
No.
Okay. The night you were in these woods, had y'all been in the water?
Yeah, we've been in the water. We was in the, playing around in it.
You were playing around in the water? All right. What were you doing in the water? Besides just playing? I mean, the little boys, had they been in the water? Did they get in the water y'all?
No, they didn't get in the water with us.
Okay. What were you doing in the water?
We were just sitting there throwing stuff at each other.
Okay. Were y'all having sex?
No, I wasn't.
You weren't?
No.
Was Damien and Jason having sex?
They take turns going up under the water.
Going under the water. What were they doing under the water?
I don't know. They sit so far away, they go up in the water, stay for about 5-10 seconds, and then come up, and the other one go down.
Okay. So they were just messing around in the water. All right. They called for these boys to come over there?
Yeah, they seen the boys, and then they hollered. They been hollering. Say, hey, and the boys came out there.
Did they call them by name?
Uh-uh. They just hollered, and then they just showed up.
Where did the boys put their bikes?
Close right there before you come in.
Mm-hmm.
They laid it down right there.
Okay.
And I don't know what, after I left, I don't know what they did with the body.
You didn't do anything to the bikes at all?
No.
Are you sure?
Positive.
You didn't touch the bikes?
I didn't touch them.
Right. You've been back to this place since that murder,
mm-hmm.
since it took time to collapse. What did you do while you were there? Be truthful.
I'll sit down there. I just sit there after what they did to the boys. I just sit there.
And did what?
Just thought what happened to them real bad. I just thought.
Okay.
And then I left and stuff.
And stuff?
I just left and walked on.
When did you go back there?
2 or 3 days after it happened. Not left.
Were you there by yourself?
I was there by myself.
Did Did you go there with some more boys, Juan?
Me, David, and Dennis.
To that particular place?
No, not to that. Okay.
Are you willing to go down there with us and us have a camcorder and you show us where these things took place? Could you do that? Wouldn't have any problem with that. But you would be able to point out where these things took place,
mm-hmm.
which way the boys came from,
mm-hmm.
and where y'all were when he hollered for the boys, and stuff like that. You wouldn't have any problem with that?
Because after the murder and stuff, like I said, about 2 or 3 days later after it happened, I went in and thought about it, and I ain't been there since.
Okay. Let me ask you something. This is real serious, and I want you to be real truthful. And I want you to think about it before you answer it. Don't just say yes or no real quick. I want you to think about it. Did you actually hit any of these boys?
No.
Now tell us the truth.
No.
Okay. Did you actually rape any of these boys?
No.
Did you actually kill any of these boys?
No.
Did you see any of the boys actually killed?
Yes.
Okay. Which one did you see killed?
That right there.
That you're pointing to the Byers boy again?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
And how was he actually killed?
He did. He choked him real bad, like.
Choking him? Okay. What was he choking him with?
It was like a little, like a stick. It was a little stick and kind of holding it over his neck.
Okay. So he was choking him to the point where he actually went unconscious? So at that point, you feel like he was dead?
Yeah.
Okay. Did any of the other two boys, were you there when they were actually killed?
No.
You say you got sick of what you were saying. Did you throw up or anything?
Mm-hmm.
Where did you throw up at?
I got a little bit of ways after we took seeing that. I left about half a mile up the road when I threw up and stuff. I couldn't hardly run or nothing. I just threw up.
When you left from there, did you leave running?
Mm-hmm.
Were you hiding?
I didn't hide.
You had some blood on your clothes?
I had no blood on me. I didn't get close to them.
Were your clothes wet still?
Mm-hmm. They was damp.
Muddy?
Mm-hmm.
All right, Inspector Gitchell touched on a point. Real, real close. Now, what clothes was Jason wearing that day? That night?
He wears some blue jeans and some boots, like, the army boots.
Army boots? And what kind of a shirt? I mean, you know, everybody wears a special shirt for different things.
He's wearing a Megadeth shirt.
A Megadeth?
No, Megadeth, Metallica.
Metallica shirt. All right, was he wearing a cap? Anything like that?
No, he didn't wear a cap.
All right, Damien. What was Damien wearing?
Damien had some black pants on, some boots, and a black t-shirt.
All right. Was anything on his shirt? No kind of design or anything?
Just black.
These blue jeans that Jason was wearing, they designer jeans? Were they old jeans? Wore out? Holes?
They wore out.
What did it look like?
They had holes in the knees and stuff.
Holes in the knees. What color is Jason's hair?
Blonde.
Bright blonde or like a sandy reddish type blonde? You know the difference?
It's like a sandy color blonde.
Sandy color blonde? Okay. He's wearing blue jeans. He had a Metallica shirt. This is a shirt that's got Metallica across the front of it spelled out and a man's name or something under it or a picture. Is that right? You tell me.
They had pictures.
Picture of somebody?
Different shirts and, you know, different Metallica shirts got different pictures.
Well, which one did he have?
He had the, like a, the sky skull on it and stuff like
that. A skull? Okay. What were you wearing that day?
I was just wearing regular blue jeans, my shoes, and
What kind of shoes were you wearing?
My, Adidas.
Adidas tennis shoes? Mm-hmm. Okay. What kind of shirt were you wearing?
I was just wearing a regular, one of my old greasy up t-shirts.
Okay. Was it a design shirt, like this Bull Run type shirt, or was it just a plain white, old t-shirt? Where are these shoes at now?
A friend of mine got them. He borrowed them.
All right. Who is that?
Buddy Lucas.
Buddy Lucas?
He borrowed them from him.
The boots that Damien had on, are they army type boots too, or what kind of boots were they?
It's close to like army type, not quite.
Okay. They're black. Is that right? Lace up? And Jason's black, lace up.
Jason's black up to about 3/4 wide.
Oh, they come way up on him. Yeah. Okay. Damien's didn't come up that far. Mm-hmm. Okay. Okay. When they killed the boys, you decided to go. You went home. How long after you got home before you received the phone call? 30 minutes? An hour? An hour after you got home? Okay. So they were there for a lot longer. Mm-hmm. When he called you on the phone, did he say he just got in?
He called me when he first got home. He called me. He said, how come I left? I told him I couldn't stand it. I had to do some mails.
Okay. You couldn't stand it.
And then I heard Damien in the background saying, we done it, what we gonna do now? What about if somebody saw us?
Okay. Did anybody see you leave?
No.
That you know of?
That I know of.
Did anybody see Damien and Jason?
I don't know, I left before them.
But have you heard anybody say that they saw Damien and Jason? Uh-huh. You hadn't heard anybody? Okay. Now these initiations, you said they eat part of the leg muscles, leg meat. Would that involve eating part of the penis of the animal? Just the meat.
Just the meat.
Has Jason and Damien talked to you since this happened? Mm-hmm. They haven't talked to you about this?
They ain't said nothing around me. Well, not because I'm around some of my friends. They don't say nothing.
Well, when you've been by yourself, and I'm sure in the last 3 weeks you've been by yourself with them sometime.
I mean, with Damien, he keeps on asking me how come I left and stuff. And has anybody said anything to me about it?
Okay. What did he say about when you came to the police department? That boy, you seeing that boy in the woods up there behind the Goodyear place. What did he say about that?
He didn't know nothing about that.
He doesn't know that?
Uh-uh.
Okay. What about when you get with Jason by himself?
He keeps on asking me what we're going to do next. I told him I can't do nothing now because I go with my dad every day. I make a excuse school.
So they're scared. Is that right?
That's good, because after what they did, I told them, I just bring a pair of excuse. I got to work with my dad every time or something. I had to do something.
Well, what do you think ought to be done to them for killing these boys?
I think they need to be put away for a while.
Put away for a while. You think they're sick or just mean?
I think they're sick.
They're sick. Okay. Is there anything else you want to add to this statement?
No.
Why did you not come forward with this information?
Because I was scared.
Scared of Damien or scared of the police?
Scared of the police.
Are you scared of Damien now?
No.
Are you scared of the police now?
No.
You're not? So we've treated you well. All right. I'm going to conclude this interview. The time is 3:18.